Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. Have you ever wondered what fear, nuclear war, Richard Branson, and ice cream have in common? Today, our very special guest, a three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee, provides the prescription for a bully-free schoolyard by employing an unlikely and very successful strategy used during global peace negotiations. She shares her business plan for peace and provides inspiring examples of unifying kindness movements across the globe. Dr. Cilla Elworthy will have you laughing, crying, and feeling more inspired about your role in the world. Dr. Cilla Elworthy is a three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee for her work with Oxford Research Group to develop effective dialogue between nuclear weapons policymakers worldwide and their critics. She was awarded the Nuano Peace Prize in 2003 and was advisor to Peter Gabriel, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Sir Richard Branson in setting up the Elders. Her latest book, The Business Plan for Peace, Building a World Without War, has just come out in 2017. And her other book, Pioneering the Possible, Awakened Leadership for a World That Works, came out in 2014. And both have received critical acclaim from experts in the field. Her TED Talk on nonviolence has been viewed over 1.1 million times. To find her online, visit www.cillaelworthy.com. S-C-I-L-L-A-E-L-W-O-R-T-H-Y. Or for more information, visit my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search episode 2. Thanks so much for listening. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. Dr. Cilla Elworthy, thank you so much for being on the Small Act, Big Impact Kindness Podcast. I really appreciate you taking time out of what must be a very, very busy schedule, judging from all of the different endeavors and organizations that you're involved in. So thank you very much for being here today.
You're welcome. I'm delighted to be talking with you.
Me too. So I'm going to start right away by talking a little bit about inspiration and how being inspired can propel us into action. So I was struck by your recounting of the second time you heard Nelson Mandela speak. You said you got chills or goosebumps, which lasted well into that 30-minute period of his speech, and you attributed it to the sheer energy of his integrity. I think it stuck with me because really putting that feeling into words, that's the feeling that we all get when a leader moves us emotionally to the point of winning us over, to the point of causing us to sit up in our seat and not only understand an issue with our heads and our hearts, but also decide to move forward and take action with our hands. So thinking about that inspiration and how important it is for meaningful action, and the fact that that emotional piece is so important, can you speak to the context of that inspiration within that grassroots social justice movement and that sort of movement that's happening across the world?
My experience is that right now people are taking the initiative in their own communities to bring about peaceful outcome of whatever it is, whatever the challenges are that they face. And working alongside Nelson Mandela and Archbishop Desmond Tutu in setting up the Elders, which I was assisting with, I had this extraordinary experience, which I've never had before, which was when Nelson Mandela started speaking. And he's not a great orator. He's got quite a raspy voice, and he doesn't make extravagant phrases or anything like that. But when he started speaking, I got goosebumps. And then 30 minutes later, when he stopped speaking, I still had goosebumps, and I've never experienced that before. Normally it's just a minute or two. And so I asked myself, what is this? What's going on? And it took me a long time to realize that it was actually the energy of his integrity that had reached me viscerally in a bodily sense. And I carried that with me, carried that with me ever since. And I believe it's the kind of impulse or energy that helps us to carry on doing what needs to be done for our communities, for our workplace, for people who are having difficulty or even at war around us. We need that the energy of that integrity to be able to keep going. Sometimes it's very hard work bringing about a peaceful outcome between people who dislike each other or cannot understand each other.
Mm. And that energy is what compels you to continue in spite of how difficult or challenging that adversity is when we come up against the challenges. And
yes. Yeah, I think so. And I think it's partly a sense that I've had ever since I was a teenager, a sense of outrage at what's happening in the world, what stupid decisions are being made by our leaders, and wanting to add whatever I could to try to bring about a safer world, a world that would be more friendly, more warm, more open, more honest, and more kind. And that's why I like the sound of what you're doing, which has all those values embedded in it.
Thank you. And I'd like to talk a little bit about you and your background and your experience and how some of that has actually challenged some of the assumptions you held to be true. So Archbishop Desmond Tutu wrote in the foreword of your book, Pioneering the Possible, Awaken Leadership for a World That Works, that the world is in crisis, that it needs people who have the skill to combine inner power with outer action. You've given the world essentially a roadmap for doing just that, and the journey started really early for you. So you've spoken about your experience as a 13-year-old girl being viscerally affected by the violence and the brutality that you witnessed on television when the Soviet tanks mowed down students who were marching in protest of the Marxist-Leninist government in Budapest in 1956. And you wanted to do something to change the world. And your mother reminded you that you needed to have more wisdom, more knowledge, more training. And as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because the internet can sometimes be incorrect, but you spent a lot of your 20s in Africa really learning firsthand about stories of injustice and being a champion for the marginalized, receiving training and learning to fight oppression. So how did your experience with violence and oppression change some of the assumptions that you once held to be true as it relates to how we can respond effectively to diminish it? So in other words, what have you come to understand truly works to reduce political, physical, and emotional violence? How can we really affect positive change in this world?
Well, after I was only 13 when I really wanted to go to Budapest, not even knowing where Budapest was. And my mum told me quite rightly that I needed to get training. And so she sent me off to work in a holiday home for people who'd been in concentration camps. So they were people who'd been in Auschwitz and so on. And I sat peeling potatoes for the whole of one summer holiday, listening to the stories of these people. And I was so moved and so inspired that they, who had suffered probably the worst cruelty and injustice that you could imagine and survived could restart their lives, could still be good listeners, could still be kind, could still be gentle. And that moved me so deeply. Mm. And then I took myself off to work in camps for Vietnamese refugees who were coming, fleeing the Vietnam War. And then I went to work in an orphanage for kids who'd lost their parents in the Algerian War. Mm. And so that was deep in the suburbs of Algiers. And those kind of experiences taught me that even children, very young children, who have been so traumatized by war, can still, with understanding and with counseling and with help, they can grow strong again. They can reestablish their faith in human nature. And that those of us who have had a comparatively safe upbringing and not been shot at all our lives, we have almost a privilege and a capacity to help, to do something, to make the lives of people who have suffered so seriously and been so badly injured mentally, psychologically, or physically. It's almost an honor to stop in our tracks and think about them and use our capacity, our own education, our own safety, as it were, to help and contribute to others. I think that's what this century is going to be about. If you look back at the 20th century, you could say that the mantra of the 20th century was, what can I get? I believe that the mantra of the 21st century is going to be, what can I give? Mm. So service and putting ourselves at the disposal of people less fortunate than ourselves and helping to heal the terrible violence that there is in our cities and in our communities, even in our schools. That's the job of those of us who haven't directly experienced that.
Mm, that is so profound. And it makes me think of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, in many ways, especially when you brought up the Auschwitz camp survivors, because I think on a fundamental level, whether we, as you say, whether we grow up in privilege or we grow up in trauma and repeated trauma for many and ongoing, and it comes down to this ability to be resilient in the face of those challenges and to find hope in the face of something or a situation that feels completely permeated with despair. Can you speak to the difference between hope and despair and how leaders and even grassroots change makers can become inspired to see the hope in spite of that adversity, the hardships, the struggle they see and experience within their immediate lives? How can they cultivate the imagination that's required to visualize a different tomorrow and even create a map for that?
Hmm. Well, I think people who feel despairing often almost need to walk towards their despair. Mm. Because mainly when we feel depressed or despairing or very afraid, we feel we're almost pursued by a dark cloud or a monster or evil in some form. And what we do normally is to run away from it and kind of, you know, hope it'll go away or get weaker or whatever. Mm-hmm. My experience and that of many of my colleagues has been the opposite, that we need to and we can do, and in fact the best thing to do is walk towards it. Mm-hmm. So To give you an example, if I'm being woken in the middle of the night by a terrible, threatening voice, often usually my own inner critical voice that tells me I haven't done enough or I haven't prepared for a talk that I've got to give or I haven't done the right thing by somebody, and it will wake me up and I will toss and turn for half an hour perhaps until I actually get up. And what I do, it might not work for everybody, but what I do, and it works every time, is I put two cushions and I sit on one cushion and that's me. And then the dark voice, or I call it my dragon, is sitting on the other cushion. And so I say to it, why did you wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning? And the dragon will, then I have to go and move and physically sit in the other, on the other cushion. And then I speak, it sounds incredible, but it's true. I speak with the voice of that dark being, that dragon. And the dark being or dragon will say something like, well, you didn't prepare properly for what you've got to do tomorrow, and you're just going to fail the people who'll be there, and really it'll really tear into me. So then I shift back to my own cushion and I say to it, that's not very helpful. And so I'm not going to have it. So I say to it, I know that you know some things that will help me deal with what I have to deal with tomorrow. So I would like you to be more helpful and tell me what I need to know. So then I go back and sit on the dragon's cushion, and it starts to speak in a different tone. And it starts to say, well, you should have done this and that. Well, you could do it. If you get up early enough in the morning, you could still be ready for what you need to do. So what you need to do is look up this and look up that, and then prepare 3 or 4 points. And so I listen to that, and then I come back to my seat and I say, okay, but where do I look for this inspiration? Where do I turn? Because I don't know where to look. And then I go back to the dragon seat, and it will actually tell me chapter and verse of what I need to know. It will direct me either to call somebody or where to look on the internet or whatever, very precisely.
Wow.
And it's amazing. So I'm convinced that that dark voice that we all have can be transformed into a very helpful voice. And the way I envisage it is that the dragon, I have a real beautiful picture of a dragon, and underneath his left claw is a diamond. And so what I'm after in confronting him is to know what that diamond is, because it's a diamond of truth that I can learn through this very challenging experience. Does that make sense?
It really does. I'm nodding my head, and I'm touched actually by that analogy, because I think it's true. And I think what you're speaking of is that fear inside that tells us that we're unworthy and reminds us all the time. And our knee-jerk reaction is often to push it away or conceal it or numb it out in whatever way we can. And what I'm hearing you say is that, in fact, not only do you confront it, but you're compassionate to it. You listen to the important part of what it has to say. So it's not screaming at you anymore. It's not a destructive force anymore, but you give it the space and you listen to the wisdom within that voice without letting it run the show, essentially. And I think that's such a profound thing to realize is, you know, this power of fear in our life and this ancient part of our brain that urges us to resist change at all cost and to cling to the status quo and the certainty of our lives. I mean, that's a really important part of most of our experiences. And I think a lot of us don't necessarily gravitate toward the positive within that fear. And I think about that specifically as it relates to letting go of perfectionism and that sense of unworthiness. Can you discuss a little bit how fear has the power to hold us back from standing in our integrity as it relates to the important work that you've done in international relations and within your own journey personally? Even, you know, how we can approach, how we communicate with one another can be affected by this unworthiness. So how can we sort of stand in that integrity and overcome that fear, I suppose, in order to present our best selves?
Well, I do think it's a matter of daily practice, really, because what we need to build is a core strength that runs through the middle of our body, where the chakras are. I'm sure you know what the different chakras are. Mm. And they are the energy points of our body. And they go right from the bottom of our coccyx, sitting bones, right through through our solar plexus, to the heart, to the throat, to the third eye between the eyebrows, and ultimately to the crown of our head and even above. And if we can develop a daily practice which allows us to connect up with those they are definitely energy points, and thereby become aware of ourselves and almost build the ability to observe ourselves, to see what we're up to in the daily life. Now, this might seem a long way from your question, but if we begin that kind of practice, even in just for 10 minutes a day, just to stay quiet and sort of, it's like self-reflection, like self-examination. Mm-hmm. And then maybe do it with a friend, so that you're really learning to be authentic, to touch into your core strength. Because each one of us has so much more core strength than we acknowledge, than we know. And when we're afraid, we get paralyzed and we get all the blood drains away from the brain, and we can't think anymore, and we get frightened of a particular person or a situation. So to have a daily way of connecting with what you might call your higher self through your central core is, to my way of thinking, essential. And the younger that we learn to do that, I mean, small children can learn to do it.
Yes.
And small children love to dwell in that kind of quietness. Can I tell you a little story about?
I would love that.
Well, I have a allotment, which is like a small piece of garden within a much bigger garden. And I have a little greenhouse there. And I think you would call it a glass house. It's tiny. And I have a chair in there, and I sit there in the greenery and amongst the vegetables and have a little reflection every day. And I love doing that. And one day, my little neighbor, who's 6 years old, came to visit me, because he likes to plant seeds with me and pick vegetables and so on. And he saw me sitting there, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm just reflecting. I'm sort of meditating." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, it's like yoga. Do you know what yoga is?" And he said, "No." So I said, "Well, we can meditate together if you like." And he said, "Okay." So I brought him a little stool, and he sat opposite me, and we put a little candle in the middle. And I said, what would you like to meditate on? And he thought for a long time, and he said, rhubarb. So I said, okay, we'll meditate on rhubarb. So I taught him to breathe. And we all think we know how to breathe, but we mostly don't. Mm. And the secret of breathing is to breathe in for a count of five and out for a count of 10. Mm. And then in for a count of five, out for a count of 10. At least 10 times. And you'll find when you do that, that your whole being slows down. Mm. And that you get access to a much greater source of wisdom than you would otherwise. Mm. So that's what I taught him to do. Now he turns up at all times and says, what are you doing? Are you meditating? Can we meditate? And so we've meditated on snails and nails and cabbages and all sorts of things. Mm. And it's just an introduction for him to the joy of tapping into another world, if you like.
Yes.
And he thinks it's magic.
Oh, and it is magic. I think that ability to be introspective in such a way that you sort of remove your ego self from it and you can just sit in who you are on a very deep level. It is magic. And I think that you've spoken about this reflective or introspective practice, this ability to have inner knowledge. You've talked about that in order to really make positive change in the world, we really ought to start by knowing ourselves. And it sounds as though this meditative practice or reflective practice is part of the secret key to get to that inner knowledge. How would you say that inner knowledge or this reflective ability allows us to be better leaders, better teachers, better parents, and even to have the ability to help children to become change makers themselves?
Hmm. Well, I think, first of all, it allows us to feel grounded. And by grounded, I mean to feel that we are standing steady on the earth, and that we have also a connection above our heads to what you might call the infinite, a greater intelligence. And that's a great reassurance if you feel rooted and grounded, and you feel you've got this lovely vertical feeling of being connected to a higher intelligence. That's a great, great help in overcoming fear and self-consciousness and feeling inadequate and all the feelings that everybody has, even the most successful people are subject to what they call the imposter syndrome. In other words, even the very top politicians, civil servants, officials, military men and women say that they still think one day somebody's going to catch them out and find out who they really are. So we've all got that self-doubt, however successful we are, and it attacks us at different times. So if you have it, however old you are or young you are just a member of the human race. That's what it's like to be a human, that we have those negative voices. So having this... it's like having a balcony view, having a different insight into the world around us and into what's going on that might be challenging or frightening. So I think that's the first secret for those of us who work with young people or with children, to be with them from that sense of our own serenity, if you like, of calmness and of generosity, because that being rooted and grounded makes you much more able to be generous and loving.
Yes, I would absolutely agree. And I think I think it's that ability to tune in, and then also to cultivate that ability to, you know, be inclusive, be generous, and have the, just those, what you've referred to as this feminine intelligence, and tap into some of those things that really nurture the human race, this ability to see one another, to support one another. How would you say that these skills, this feminine intelligence, first of all, if you could define what that is for us, that would be great. Okay. And then also to talk about how that can carry us into the 21st century in terms of when we think of raising these leaders of tomorrow, how can teaching them to tune in not only to their own inner knowledge, but also these skills and these abilities to be generous and to be critical thinkers and to be inclusive and all of those skills, how can that help arm them for the uncertainty that lies before them?
Well, first of all, I think that, we all know that feminine intelligence, which is available equally to men and to women, has been marginalized for centuries, thousands of years. Everything to do with the feminine has been left out of the major decisions that have been made in the world. And look at the mess we're in as a result. Mm. I mean, it's just so obvious, you know, with so much violence, so many weapons being traded, so many people making money out of chaos, and so much to make us feel unsafe or challenged. And so what it's really obvious to me and all my colleagues working in this now, that feminine intelligence, which we call FEMMEQ, F-E-M-M-E-Q, mm-hmm. Needs to be understood and needs to be brought into decision making and into government policy and into military policy and so on. That's what we're busy doing. So let me just say what we feel FEMMEQ is. First of all, it's about compassion. And compassion is when, I think compassion's a bit different from empathy, because some people, when they feel very empathetic, get a bit lost in the feelings of the other person, and they can get overwhelmed with what's called empathic distress. Mm-hmm. And that disenables them from really doing anything. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're compassionate, it always calls on you to act. Compassion always comes with action. So, like, if you passed a very hungry person asking for money on the street, rather than walking past and feeling guilty, what you would do is go to the nearest shop, buy a sandwich, come back with the sandwich and give it to the hungry person. Mm-hmm. So you would make an action rather than just feeling bad or feeling sorry for them. So compassion is the developing the ability to feel in the other person's shoes, understand how they're feeling, and always that starts with listening. Mm. So listening is the second major quality. It's huge. We all think we're good listeners, and very few of us are. Most of us, when we're listening to someone else, we're kind of thinking what we're going to say next, or how that, you know, what we remember having felt like that or something. Mm. But if we really, really listen to another person, give them our full attention, there's no greater gift we can give them, because it means that they are being fully received and fully heard. Mm. And this is, to my way of thinking, it's what I teach as the best and simplest and most profound way to heal or prevent conflict.
Yes.
So shall I touch on that, or shall I go on with the elements of feminine intelligence?
Well, what I'd really like to dig into actually is some of your work with the Oxford Research Group and with the Elders Initiative, which was because I think it really ties in, which is your work with Richard Branson and Desmond Tutu and Ban Ki-moon and Kofi Annan and many others, including Nelson Mandela, of course, and your also your initiative of the Peace Direct and how important it is to create an environment in which these different opposing forces, whether they are, you know, members of civil war or it's a situation where you are creating dialogue between nuclear weapons policymakers or whatever it is, that essentially you create the space for those individuals to have a conversation, to truly hear one another. And some of that is because you take it out of the media's radar. And I want to talk a little bit about that and how when these conversations are able to happen in a very authentic way where both sides are truly listening with a compassionate ear, truly listening to some of the fears behind the decisions that are being made, how does that bring around and bring about effective reconciliation or conversations that are productive and useful and effective?
Well, I'll have to go back quickly to 1982 when I became really frightened. I got a young daughter then, and I became really worried that there was going to be a nuclear war. And I wasn't wrong, because in 1983, the world was actually 20 minutes away from the firing of all the Russian and American missiles. But that's another story. So I decided that I wanted to find out how decisions were made on nuclear weapons and who was making them in order to render the process more accountable. Because in Britain, when there was to be a new nuclear missile developed, it was only told to our parliament when the decision had already been made. So there was nothing we could do to stop it. We were just landed with it, whether we liked it or not. And I thought that was wrong. And so I decided to try and find out who made the decisions. And everybody said, "You're nuts. You can't possibly do that. It's totally secret." And I said, "Well, I'm going to have a try." So 4 years later, and with a lot of hard work on the part of a very small team, we published our first book, which was called How Nuclear Weapons Decisions Are Made. And it had diagrams and indications of all the agencies, the intelligence agencies, the military, the weapons manufacturers, the people who designed and made the warheads, the people who signed the checks, and finally the politicians in the five nuclear countries. And then I thought, well, I'd like to get these individuals to talk to each other, because it was perfectly clear to me that they didn't know their opposite numbers in other countries. And they definitely didn't talk to their informed critics. So I started to bring together people who had been in the business and had opted out for ethical reasons to talk with the people who were still in the business. And it was very slow work, very difficult. We made lots of mistakes. But eventually we found the right way to do it and to make people feel safe enough to actually have those conversations. And that went on for 21 years. And it was all, you wouldn't have read about it in the papers and certainly not in the media, because as you mentioned, it all had to be done under the radar and at very high levels, because if say the warhead designer from Los Alamos in the States knew that the world knew that he was going to be meeting his opposite number from Russia, he wouldn't come.
Right.
And so we had to have no press, no communiques, no announcements. Everything was completely deniable. But because we pursued it and went on with it, even when we failed sometimes, we went on with it for this 21 years before I handed it over to other people. Right. And it's still going strong.
Wow.
We were able to get the basis for some treaties agreed in these meetings. So eventually it did work, but it took a lot of perseverance and so on.
Wow.
And then what happened is I became aware that right at the other end of the spectrum of violence, at local levels in countries that were torn apart by war, local people were taking their responsibility for their safety very seriously, and they were working locally to prevent war. Like I got to know a young woman in northwest Pakistan who was actually, first of all, working to get young girls into school. She was a colleague of Malala Yousafzai, who you probably know, was shot in the head for doing that and then got the Nobel Prize. Well, this was her colleague, Gululai Ismail. And Gululai went on to train young people, young men and women, to go into the madrasas, the schools where young boys were being trained for jihad, and then go with them to their families and talk to their mothers and fathers about why the Quran would not approve of suicide bombing.
Wow.
And they have so far dissuaded over 200 suicide bombers from carrying out their mission. So this is incredibly courageous, and it's happening at the grassroots level. And I decided that these people who were doing this in all parts of the world were such heroes that they needed support. So I set up an organization called Peace Direct to give them support. And that is now, that started in 2002, and it's now growing stronger than ever. It's getting bigger and bigger.
I think it's such an incredible initiative, and looking and reading up on it, I am so moved, and I know so many different organizations have been involved with the Peace Direct message and mission to essentially provide support to these individuals who are often risking their lives to demonstrate really incredible bravery and courage in the name of helping others. Can you speak more to some of these grassroots activists who, against all odds, despite marginalization, are making huge waves of this positive change within their communities? I know that there was another story that you shared about one young man in the Congo and goats. And I thought, it what an incredible story and an inspiration for so many individuals who tell themselves, A, that they don't matter, and B, that they are incapable of making change. So.
Yeah. Well, this was a young man who was himself captured and forced to be a child soldier, which means being taught to fire a weapon or use a machete when you're very young, 12 or 13, often being forced to go and kill people in your own village, sometimes from your own family, to show that you're brave. And anyway, this young man, whose name was Henri, managed to escape, and he ran through the bush for 3 days until he got to a place that took him in and helped him to recover from the trauma that he'd been through. Mm. And when he was a bit older, he decided to devote the rest of his life to freeing other child soldiers. And what he does is, when Peace Direct is able to send him a small amount of money, say $100, he gets on his motorbike and rides into the bush and buys a herd of goats. Mm. And he drives the goats to where the militia, the ones who have the child soldiers, are hiding. And that in itself is taking his life in his hands, because they're trigger happy, they're high on drugs, and they don't like intruders. Mm. But Henri knows how to talk to them, and so he bargains with them for one goat, which is valued at $5, in exchange for one of the child soldiers that they are keeping in captivity.
Wow.
And then he takes those children, who are girls and boys, the girls have been made sex slaves, and he takes them back to their families. Mm. And that just, it just moves me so much.
Me
that
too.
Somebody can risk their life to free other people from slavery.
Me too. I think that story and so many of the others are incredibly moving. And I think within that is that, again, when we come back to that emotional point that tips us into acting on our inspiration, it is those stories that give us that notion that, wait a minute, maybe we can do something, and really challenge the assumption that despite the perception of our inaction or that we are not powerful enough to make change, because I think that's something that children often feel, that it's very possible and it doesn't have to be at a mass scale. It can be making a difference for just a handful of people, and that over time that really affects people on a profound level.
Absolutely. And I think children love to learn these skills. For example, little children age 5 or 6 can learn to be playground monitors at school, mm-hmm. where they learn the skills that they need to stop bullying, for example.
Yes.
And they become really good at it. And once they've learned those skills, they start teaching their parents when their parents are having a fight. It's very good.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's what it is. And I think that's why it's so important to have this conversation, the global conversation. I mean, school is a microcosm for our environment often. And so if we can learn these skills as children and carry that experience with us of being compassionate, taking courageous, bold risks for other people, that we can apply that to our lives as policymakers and within politics or within non-governmental organizations or whatever it is that we do. I think this is at the heart of my message, is that what we do in the everyday as children can be applied, and we can learn from that, and there are really profound lessons to be learned in acting this way with that compassionate sort of heart. I would like to talk briefly, and I am very mindful of time here, so I'd like to talk a little bit, because you've mentioned the corrosive and change-making power of anger. And I'm thinking about this specifically within the Canadian context of residential schools. And I'm not sure if you're familiar, but I'll just give a little bit of a background for anybody who may or may not be, that there are entire generations of our Indigenous Canadian families and populations in Canada that were devastated by the destructive and abusive practices of assimilation, cultural genocide, violence, aggression, injustice, and basically just, you know, taking away human rights. And the costs have been incredibly high, multi-generationally, and really this institutionalized racism has caused devastating effects for the population that exists now. So despite sort of these concerted efforts through the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the racism and deep distrust and inequality and really the despair continues to exist between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Canadians on, I think, a subconscious level. And I know that you've been active in reconciliation efforts within places like Rwanda and South Africa that have been known for their extreme human rights violations, genocides, deep-rooted racist policies. So how does a country move forward, developing a newfound sense of genuine trust with reconciliation in mind? How do we harness that anger that is born out of really justified injustice and violation? And how do we move forward within that context?
Well, I think anger is a very important first step, that somebody wakes up to what's going on around them and feels anger is a great advantage, really. But if you spray the anger out at other people, especially the people that are perpetrating the atrocity, you don't get very far, because they just put up their defenses. So we have to learn to keep our anger like gasoline within ourselves so that it kind of runs our engine rather than spraying it out. Because if you spray out anger, it's like gasoline sprayed out, and if you strike a match, you got an inferno. It's useless.
Yes.
Or very destructive. So we have to keep that anger within ourselves, keep looking at it, and use it as a fuel, because it's very useful for getting us up in the morning to start again when everything feels hopeless. And it's very good fuel. But ultimately, it's compassion and listening, which are the skills that are going to help us to bring about the kind of changes we want. And that's why I think it was working with Desmond Tutu that really taught me the fundamentals of this, because he said, and it was him who set up the first Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, and he said, if you want peace, don't talk to your friends, talk to your enemies.
Mm.
And to me, that's such good sense. So we have to, we need to equip ourselves so that we can enter into a dialogue with those with whom we profoundly disagree.
Mm.
And that applies whether it's trying to put right the wrongs that have been done over the centuries to the indigenous peoples of the world, and to work with them to recover their incredible ancient wisdom.
Yeah.
Because the wisdom of the first peoples is so profound and so much needed today that we need to just bow down in respect to that wisdom and try to bring it back into our culture.
I agree. And I think that's a really profound point. And I think my sense is that this isn't a simple and easy solution, obviously, but I think it's that willingness to come together, to have the difficult conversations, and to listen actively to the stories. Because I think often it's about understanding the context of what's happened in order for us to move forward, and honoring the stories. And like you said, honoring the experience that has come with that story as well. So thank you for sharing that, because it's a really profound issue currently. And it's something that's very much at the forefront of much of our media conversation, and also within education, of course, adopting a more indigenous, you know, approach to education in honoring the wisdom that has existed for so long, and really tapping into that in an explicit way. So I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
We have so many things that we could talk about, and I'm just going to be very respectful of your time and say thank you so much for answering some of these really important questions. And I'd like to finish up with some of the rapid fire questions if we can. But before we do, is there any message or anything that you'd like to say that you haven't had a chance to say at this point?
I would simply like to encourage people who are facing a conflict to say to the other person with whom you're angry, would you be willing to sit down with me for half an hour? And for the first 5 minutes, I will simply listen to you, and I'd like to ask you to speak in the first person, and without pointing finger. And I will then, after I've heard you, I will repeat back to you what I really heard you say. So I will concentrate very hard to understand what you're saying. And then we'll change over, and I will speak for 5 minutes, again in the first person, not pointing finger, and you would listen and then repeat back to me what you've heard. And then let's see where we get to, because it is worth investing half an hour in doing that together. And it can only help. We can't do any harm to our relationship doing that. We can only build a possibility for communication.
Yes. And what's interesting is I'm drawing a parallel between how you speak to others in conflict and how you speak to yourself or that fear, which is a really interesting mm-hmm. parallel because I think ultimately we can see ourselves within the people with whom we communicate. So I think when yes. we're able to do that, then that really sets the groundwork for reconciliation or conflict resolution. So thank you for mm-hmm. that. Since there is so much more to dig into, and I will have pre-recorded the intro with your information, but would you like to speak to your most recent book briefly? Just so obviously you've got some very actionable and tangible ways that people can give back to the community, to schools, to the world globally. Can you speak briefly to your newest book and perhaps how that might provide a really specific roadmap for people wanting to make a big change in the world?
Yeah, well, it's called The Business Plan for Peace. And I wrote it because I realized that we now know enough how to prevent war that we don't actually need to have war anymore. So I point out 25 different methods that are used effectively all around the world to prevent war and scale them up over a period of 10 years. And the whole thing only costs $2 billion. And we spend $9 billion every year on ice cream, just to put it in context. But the next part of the book is really dwelling on what anybody can do in their own community using these methodologies. And so I spell out 31 different things that people can do in their community, in their workplace, in the family, and I also give them a toolbox at the end of the book of the kind of thing I've been talking about, how to listen to another person, how to set up a communication when there isn't one, mm. how to run good meetings when normally people run terrible meetings, and so on and so on. Yes. So all those things. Yes. And it's available on my website if you just Google my name and you'll find my website and you can buy the book there.
And I will certainly be putting that in the show notes and, as I've mentioned, in the intro. So people will definitely be familiar with how to purchase these books that you've written. And I'm so excited for them to do so. So now we are in the final portion. This should be pretty quick because it's basically five questions that ask you within about a phrase or even less to mm-hmm. answer. Okay. So mm-hmm. could you define what kindness means to you?
Mm. Open heart, gentleness, and thinking into the shoes of the other. Mm.
What book or books have you gifted most to people?
Eckhart Tolle's book called, A New Earth. Mm. I suppose that's one of the most, and a novel by Hermann Hesse called Siddhartha. Mm.
Thank you. What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
The ability to listen.
Mm. Would it be different for a principal?
How do you mean a principal?
Oh, I'm sorry, a teacher, like an educational leader of a school? Yes, that's right. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think it's true for everybody. Mm.
And finally, what message or quote would you print on a quote cup that, you know, those ones that are sold in big bookstores that could be read by millions?
If you want peace, don't talk to your friends, talk to your enemies.
Mm. Thank you so much. This is probably a wonderful way to end off our conversation. Your inspiration and insight is really incredibly moving, and my mind is buzzing, and I'm so just excited to dig into some of these ideas that you've presented. And I think it's such an important conversation for teachers and leaders and global leaders to have. So thank you so much for your generosity and your time.
It's been a great pleasure, Morgan. Thank you for asking me all the good and difficult questions.
Thanks.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.